Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I'm Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive myths which are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring behind the headlines while predicting how these events will shape our world. Today, in our first hour, we're going to engage God on His terms, through evidence and reason, since His is the lone reliable voice, the lone sensible voice in what is an exceedingly troubled and confused world. During our second hour, we will engage IQ Al-Rasuli, and we'll talk about a number of things, including how different the situation is in Turkey with the other revolts that have transpired over these past 2 years in the Islamic world. And we will turn our attention to Syria, where the United Nations is now saying that half of the Syrian population will be dependent upon international aid to survive, and how we should deal with that reality. We're going to return to where we were in our review of Yahweh's instructions. We were reading the review that Moshe provided for us of God's instructions, the 10 statements that he etched on the two tablets. They are a summation of God's overall instruction to us. They outline not only the terms and conditions of the covenant, the means that God is providing to our salvation, but also provide us with guidelines as to how we can respond to God and to our fellow man in the manner that is the most beneficial. As we made our way through the first tablet, we were on the third statement on the first tablet, which is an expansion, if you will, of what God mentioned in the second of two statements. If you recall, in the second of two statements, God's principal focus is on encouraging us not to be religious. He doesn't want us to surround ourselves with religious imagery or political imagery. He doesn't want us bowing down in a religious setting. He doesn't want us speaking on behalf of or pledging our loyalty to any religious or political group. And after he makes that statement, in saying how opposed he is to religion, which is, the first requirement of the covenant, you have to walk away from Babylon, from religion and politics, before we can engage in a relationship with God. He then tells us that our fathers have corrupted their children, and that their children corrupted their children, and their children corrupted their children, and on it goes. And that the way that the children are corrupted is, if you read this in context, is by religion and politics. And so God wants those who perpetrate such corruptions to know that there is a consequence to them of doing so, not only to their children. Not only are they providing a death sentence to their children, what they themselves will endure for having deliberately misled them or being part of a political or religious institution is that they will be judged. Because God says they will not be forgiven. To not be forgiven, you have to be judged and found guilty. And then there is no remedy. Well, those who are judged will find their way into the abyss, into Sheol, into eternal separation from God. So this is a very serious issue. Now, we considered the overall statement in our program yesterday. I'm going to share it with you once again, and then we're going to focus on the words, because there has been a considerable amount of malfeasance here, particularly within the rabbinical community, and this has spilled over into the Christian community. God actually said, "You shall not lift up, bear, or advance through the name or reputation of Yahweh your God. Accordingly, lifeless and worthless deception." nor devastating and destructive falsehood. For indeed, Yahweh will not forgive or leave unpunished those who relationally deceive, beguile, or delude in association with his name to promote in effect vain and ineffectual lies which lead to lifelessness and destruction. God is quite clear in what it is that he is opposed to, and he has stated quite clearly the consequences of doing what he has encouraged us not to do. Our choice, free will. He's not going to stop anyone from corrupting his testimony, from misleading, from being religious, or from being political. Your choice. You can do as you please. He's just telling you that there's a consequence. And that somewhere along the threshold of being a victim of religion and your soul simply ceasing to exist upon your mortal death, and perpetrating the deception where you are judged and will be eternally separated from God, that somewhere along that path that you cross that threshold. It is something to be very sober about if you are promoting religion. And if you're one of those who might stumble onto this show and say, well, this person isn't embracing Christianity, but is instead exposing and condemning Christianity. And in the second hour today, rather than embracing Islam, is exposing and condemning Islam. If you're one of those who would say, well, then, you know, you're going to go write me or the station and protest and threaten and talk about some justification for the idiocy of your religion, then you may be crossing that threshold. It's something to be very sober about. God does not take religious corruption well. He does not take religion well. He hates religion. Matter of fact, you could make the statement, God damn religion, and you would be speaking clearly and effectively for him. So, this being the case, let's look at the words themselves. There are two words here that are easily misconstrued. And so, let's examine them one at a time. The first of them is NASA. The question really with NASA is that the shin, sin, the S in NASA, it's written nun, either shin or sin, and then elf. Three letters. The issue here is that so many Hebrew words that are pointed now as a sin or a shin, the only difference is that the current Hebrew letter looks like a W in both letters, and that there is a diacritical mark on the right side of the upper leg of the, you know, there's three upward legs on a W. On the top right, there's a diacritical mark for shin, the SH sound, and there is a diacritical mark on the left side for sin, just the simple S sound. Now, in Paleo Hebrew, there was the shin, and then there was the shemek, which was the simple S sound. And so you have to always be careful any time you're trying to translate a word that you're not bamboozled by rabbinic copy edits, and you look at both potential meanings, because there is really a great opportunity for malfeasance here. And so depending on whether it is nun shin or nun sin alf, we see two distinctly different ideas. The Masoretic pointing suggests you shall not NASA with the sin, you shall not lift up, advance, support, or tolerate. This is in the Masoretic vowel pointing, it is don't be politically correct. You shall not lift up, advance, support, or tolerate. You shall not accept or respect. While the alternative and equally valid rendering of these three letters warns us, and that would be the nun Shin Alf, you should not Nasha, deceive or delude, cleverly tricking people, beguiling them, and causing them to miss the way. Now, I prefer the second. And the reason I prefer the second is that we're talking about an unforgivable sin here. This is someone being judged. And it is such a fine line between tolerating, accepting a religious corruption and being someone who advances it and supports it, which would be the first interpretation of Nasha. And we're recognizing here that this is the ultimate distinction on the bad side. Either your soul's going to cease to exist or you're going to be sent to Sheol for all eternity, separated from God. Boy, that's a razor line. But there is nothing the least bit thin in terms of the interpretation of deception, delusion, cleverly tricking people, beguiling people, and causing them to mix the way. That would mean any Christian pastor or evangelist in Christianity. And because these were all written in the imperfect, it requires ongoing and continual behavior in this regard as opposed to an occasional and now previous and ceased behavior. For example, I used to be a Christian evangelist. I have long since ceased being a Christian evangelist, so I am no longer guilty of this. That's a good thing, because it's an unforgivable sin. So, personally, while I think either is acceptable, you should not consistently, continually, or on an ongoing basis deceive or delude, cleverly tricking people, beguiling them, and causing them to miss the way. You know, the whole notion of Pauline doctrine, which is that the Torah is irrelevant, it never had the power to save anyone. You are saved through belief or faith in the gospel of grace, causes people to miss the way, because in faith there is no information, in belief there is no way, and without the Torah, the way that God has provided is annulled. And so the entire religion of Christianity, as is the religion of Islam, causes people to miss the way. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So we're considering again the consequences of Nasha as to was God saying you shall not lift up, advance, support, or tolerate, or, and then we'll look at Shoah, which is often transliterated incorrectly as Shav, in a moment, so we understand what it is that we should not embrace, support, tolerate, respect, or promote. Or was he saying just straight out, don't deceive, don't delude, don't cleverly trick people, don't beguile people, causing them to miss the way? Either is instructive, and this is beyond life and death here. This is not the question of whether or not you get admitted into Yahweh's home in heaven or you cease to exist. This is you either cease to exist if you're being judged by this criterion, or you spend eternity in Sheol. This is a real serious issue here. Now, moving on to the second interesting term. Since there is no V in Paleo or Babylonian Hebrew, corrupting the law so that it conveys the V sound instead of the O or U sound, is a modern contrivance. Shav, as it is transliterated in most lexicons, is actually Shoah. Its connotations range from ravage and devastate to lifelessness and desolation, from emptiness and falsehood to vanity, futility, and failure, even deceit, deception, and fraud. Shoah can be rendered worthless lying as well as ineffectual teaching, which leads to nothingness, but also ravaged, devastated, wasted, and ruined. So when you see these connotations associated with Shoah, then you recognize it is entirely permissible to translate Nasha either way. Because if you translate it, lift up, advance, tolerate, respect, support, promote, then it conveys the same kinds of things in terms of the things you ought not promote, which are that which is false, that which is lifeless, that which is devastating, that which is fraudulent, worthless lying, ineffectual teaching, leading to nothingness, wasting people's souls. So, since Shoah, in conjunction with NASA, comprised the Torah's only unforgivable sin, this is the only thing where God says, you know, this is not an issue of just simple life and death. This is an unforgivable sin. This means that you're going to be judged, and the verdict will be guilty. No forgiveness for this sin. Let's consider other passages where the Hebrew word currently vocalized shav, but originally shoah, is used. We find it in Yirmiyahu, which has been corrupted to Jeremiah 18:15. Speaking of the consequence of choosing religion over a relationship with Yahweh, we read, "Indeed, because my people have ignored, overlooked, and forgotten me, they have made smoke offerings and burned incense to empty lies, vain and worthless deceptions," Shoah. "And they have caused them to stumble and falter, walking in ancient ways, along a path in a way of life which does not build up or lift up." All right, so here Shoah is set into a religious setting. Smoke offerings and burned incense. Very, very religious connotation in the ancient world. And what God said is that by being religious, he has been ignored and forgotten. Now, that is the irony of religion. All religions think that they are directing people to God, that they're focusing people's attention on God. If you look up religion, that's what you're going to read. If you ask somebody who's religious, that's what they're going to say. And yet what God is saying here is the opposite of that. That by being religious, you're ignoring him. That by being religious, you're forgetting him. That religions instead must focus on somebody other than God. And indeed they do. The Lord, which is Satan. So rather than religions leading people to God, God is saying the opposite here. That religions lead people away from him. That's why he's opposed to them. He's speaking of these religious environments that cause people to forget him, to ignore him, to overlook him. He calls the religious undertakings empty lies, vain and worthless deceptions. Now, since the path to God is a path that we walk, God is saying that those empty deceptions and vain lies cause people to stumble and falter. He says that they cause them to walk in ancient ways, along a path of life which does not build up or lift up. Walking along the path of the ancient ways is to walk the path of pagan religions, to be lost in the world of Babylon. God has been very clear with us here in Yirmiyahu. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So here, the definition of Shoah is as empty lies and vain and worthless deceptions, is being explicitly disassociated from God and directly associated with traditional religious traditions. This perspective renders the third summary statement that Yah etched in stone an overt attack on religion. And keep in mind, Yirmiyahu was expressly written to Goyim, to Gentiles. So when Yirmiyahu exposes and condemns traditional religion, it's condemning the religions of the Gentiles. And what is the most popular religion in world history of the Gentiles? Christianity. And now when you look at Christianity, what do you find? That almost every central pillar of Christianity is based upon Babylon. It's Trinity, purely Babylonian, no scriptural support for it. God says the opposite. It's cross, Babylonian. There's no scriptural support for it of any kind. The name Jesus and Christ, no scriptural support for it. You look at its holiest days, Christmas and Easter. both initially celebrated as part of pagan traditions in Babylon. And the Roman Catholic and the Orthodox Christian reverence for Mary, the Madonna and Child, purely Babylonian. And on it goes. The concept of a priesthood, of paid clergy, all Babylonian. The steeples traced back to ancient Babylon. It's almost every aspect of Christianity is Babylonian. No basis at all in Scripture. And so God is being quite blunt here. In fact, God actually speaks about Christmas and Easter. You know, he talks about the Christmas tree and how utterly stupid it is and how much of an abomination it is. He speaks of Ishtar and Astarte, Astarte, various names for the Madonna that is the basis of Easter. And rallying around doing celebrations associated with Easter and condemns them. Sunday worship, of course, the central aspect of Christianity. Babylonian. That's where it was, where it began. Calling Sunday the Lord's Day, as it's done in Christianity. Purely Babylonian. A God who dies is Babylonian. A God who's physically, bodily resurrected, Babylonian. Those things are not scriptural. Then in Mizmor, which means song in Hebrew, Psalm 24, 3 and 4, we discover that the Messiah is the living embodiment of the third statement. In the context of Shabbat, the promise of seven, which defines the Shabbat, God redefines, or refines, I should say, the meaning of lo nasa. So that's the other word that we want to consider, particularly in the context of lo nasa shoah. Who is he who will ascend, rising upon Yahweh's mountain? And who is he who will take a stand and establish on his set apart and purifying dwelling place? The one whose hands are innocent and whose nature and heart are pure, radiant light. The one who by association does not lift up, support, tolerate, or forgive. The soul who promotes vain and ineffectual delusions, which lead to lifelessness and destruction. Nasa Shoah. He does not swear oaths or make promises which are deceitful, deceptive, misleading, and dishonest. So here we're being told that the Messiah, who's the one who shall ascend, rising upon Yahweh's mountain, the one who established the set-apart dwelling place, the one whose hands were innocent and pure, the one who will return as radiant light. Speaking of the Messiah Yahusha, the psalm says that the Messiah Yahusha will be directly opposed to tolerating, supporting, respecting, forgiving any soul who promotes vain and ineffectual delusions which lead to lifelessness and destruction. It's no wonder then that Yahusha was so condemning of Paul, calling him out by name, calling him out by personality, calling him out by tactic, and universally condemning him. Speaking against religion, this psalm says that Yahusha will not swear oath or makes promises which are deceitful, deceptive, misleading, or dishonest. He's going to rely on the truth. He's going to communicate the truth. He's going to affirm the Torah. He did affirm the Torah. Now, this represents Yahweh's, and by implication, Yahusha's answer regarding to how to properly interpret the third summary statement that God etched in stone. So why do you suppose that every English translation ignored God's instruction on this life and death matter rendering the divine edict in such a nonsensical way. Thou shalt not take the name of thy Lord, thy God, in vain. Utterly nonsensical, completely inconsistent with the text itself, when God himself defined his terms, put them in a context where we could not mistake their meaning. Now, while we have found the affirmation that we were searching for, the very definition of these words in this context and what God is driving at, which is, if you promote religion, you are going to be judged and found guilty, and you will not be forgiven. Clear. You have that choice, but be careful when you make that choice, because that's the consequence. So while we have found what we were looking for, considering the power of Yahweh's prose, it would be a crime to ignore what follows. Speaking of Yahusha, the human manifestation of Yahweh, we discover, with and by means of Yahweh's blessing, he will bear our burdens. He will forgive us. He will lift us up and carry us away. And as a result of God's righteousness and justice, his means to vindication, he will save us. He's going to save this generation, even, which diligently seeks and searches for him, which cares deeply about developing a relationship with him. Those who desire and seek after the presence of Jacob. Now, this is the next statement in Mizmor Song, Psalm 24, 5, and 6. So is following Mizmor Song 24, 3, and 4. So as God tells us that he is completely intolerant of the corruptions associated with religions, of the traditional ways of Babylon and Egypt, Rome, Greece, these pagan religions that have now become manifest within the religion of Christianity. The Christian Jesus Christ is almost a stunt double for Dionysus, for Osiris, for Tammuz, for Bacchus, depending if you prefer the Roman, Egyptian, Greek, or Babylonian name. So after telling us that consequence, like any loving father, he says, okay, that's the bad side. I'm giving you the warning, your choice, but I'm going to tell you the positive side. If you turn to Yahweh by the way of him blessing us through Yahusha, you will find that God himself will bear our burdens. He's going to forgive us. He's going to lift us up. He's going to carry us away. And as a result of his means of vindication, his justice, his righteousness, he's going to save not only this generation. And save here is Yeshua. In fact, I should pronounce that more correctly. It's Yasha-u. Yasha-u. This generation which diligently seeks and searches for him. And that's the key. Are you searching for God? Do you want to know him? Are you willing to invest the time to get to know him as he is? Are you willing to search for his means of vindication, his shadaka? There's only one place you can find it. So if you're searching out the navel lint that collects in your belly button, you're probably not going to find him. If you're reading Paul's letters, I'll guarantee you, you won't find him. There's one place where he introduces himself. There's one place where he presents the terms and conditions of his covenant. There's one place where he delineates the way of salvation, the way to him. It's in the Torah. So if you're diligently searching for him there, and if you deeply care about developing a relationship with him, which can only be done through the covenant, then you'll be one of those who desires to seek after the presence of Jacob. Now, why would Jacob be listed here? You may want to know. Well, Jacob became Yisrael. He is the father of the 12 tribes, God's children. you want to be one of God's children, if you want to become Yisrael, you become Yisrael, which is means Yish Shera El, individuals who engage and endure with God. That is what leads you to that place, diligently seeking after him, recognizing that through his means of vindication, God bears our burdens, lifts us up. He saves us. It's the opposite of what Paul writes in Romans and in Galatians, where he says the Torah cannot say, well, God says, yeah, beg to differ. That's how I save you, if you deeply care about developing a covenant relationship with me, because no one is saved that's not part of the covenant. Salvation is a byproduct of the covenant. Now, there's another aspect of Jacob's name that bears mentioning here. Now, Jacob was the son of Yishak, which means laughter. He was the grandson of Abraham, and therefore he is a metaphor for the covenant. But Jacob, which is based upon the Hebrew word for heel, talks about someone who digs in their heels, who walks steadfastly, who cannot be dragged, off kilter, who is not going to stumble, who is not going to be misled and led away. That's what his name means. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. The song, this one that we are considering relative to Yahweh's instruction to us, particularly his instruction regarding how we avail ourselves of his vindication and therefore his salvation, which is to avoid at all costs being associated with, tolerating, lifting up, respecting religious corruption. Then says, lift up honor and respect, the initial and the crucial gate, the doorway. And lift up and honor and respect the eternal and everlasting doorway. And he, the glorious, honored, and revered king, who is the living manifestation of the power of the doorway, shall arrive and return. Who is this glorious and honorable king, this royal manifestation of power? Yahweh's authorized one. Yahweh's mighty one. Rise up, heaven's gate. Lift up the eternal doorway. The glorious king shall return. Who is he, this king? This king is Yahweh of hosts. His manifestation of power and his glorious presence is king. Psalm 24, 7 through 10. So many insights here. One is that Yahusha is Yahweh. Who is the king? Who is the mighty one? Who is this person who is going to do all of these things for us? Yahweh himself. All Yahusha means is that it's Yahweh saving us. He is presented as Kodesh Kodesh in the Torah, which means the most set apart. He is a set apart manifestation of Yahweh. Therefore, he is an aspect of Yahweh set apart from him to serve us. When you get all, as Christians do, fixated on a misnomer, on their Jesus Christ, what you end up doing is missing Yahweh. And all that Yahusha, which means Yahweh saves, came to do is point us to and facilitate the path toward knowing and being saved by Yahweh. This also says that the doorway and Yahweh, the doorway and Yahusha, are synonymous. What is the doorway? It's Passover. Why are the doorway and Yahusha synonymous? Because Yahusha, as promised, became the Passover lamb. That is how he accepted our iniquity through Passover, which is a... Passover isn't just the doorway, it's also the threshold, which includes unyeasted bread. That through this doorway and this gate, that God perfected us and made us immortal. And he himself is the doorway, is what he's saying here. that he is the living embodiment of Passover. And that's a shame for Christians because they don't celebrate Passover. They don't celebrate unyeasted bread. They miss the gateway. They miss the doorway. Therefore, they miss salvation. They miss life. It's also sad because they've replaced it with Easter, which is a Babylonian pagan tradition, a corruption. And they replaced it with the Eucharist and with communion, which bear no association with Passover. And so they're lost, squander their lives needlessly because their clerics, Nasa Shov, Nasa Shoa, they purposefully and deliberately promoted lies which led them astray. Well, this profound teaching brings us to the Torah's final perspective on the Shabbat instruction. The very reason that we turned to Devarim, Deuteronomy in the first place, at least in this chapter. And so that now that we have concluded with the statements that Yah etched on the first of those two tablets, we turn to the seven that he wrote on the second of the two tablets, following the pattern of 6+1, where the first of these is distinct from the others. You shall observe, Shamar, habitually, on an ongoing basis, be aware of, pay attention to, carefully consider, closely examine, revere the Shabbat. Shamar is one of the most important Hebrew words. It is almost always translated keep, even though it does not mean keep. It means to use your perception of sight, the facility of sight, to use your eyes so that you can observe what is around you, particularly Yah's Torah testimony as it is written, and based upon observing it, considering it, and then being empowered to respond appropriately. You shall observe the Shabbat. We'll return after the commercial break.